Welcome to another podcast on YuriBrito.com. I'm your host, Yuri Brito. Thanks for joining us on this fourth podcast. On this episode, I want to tackle three main issues. The first one comes from a New York Times opinion piece by Nicholas Kristof entitled, Let's Wage a War on Loneliness. The second piece, The Gettys Sound the Alarm on Contemporary Christian Music. And finally, an article in the Gospel Coalition on why the local pastor is a better pastor than Tim Keller and John Piper. I'm your host, Yuri Brito. Thanks for joining us. On this Veterans Day, I had the liberty to take some time, additional time during lunch, and read a host of articles that I've been interested in reading. A few of them caught my attention, these three in particular. But the first one spoke very deeply to me because it's something I've talked about quite a bit as a pastor. But now there is some additional evidence to bolster what I've been saying, honestly confirming what the biblical testimony has been for two millennia and continues world without end. In a piece, a very revealing one, I should say, in the New York Times, the author Nicholas Kristof makes this astounding statement. We humans, he says, make a lonely crowd, and it's killing us. And the article goes on and talks about a host of factors that make loneliness one of the worst killers in American society. The article says social isolation is more lethal than smoking 15 cigarettes a day or than obesity, according to research published by Julianne Holt Lunstead of Brigham University. Since obesity is associated in the United States with 300 to 600,000 deaths a year, the implications that loneliness is a huge, if silent, killer. The opinion piece, of course, talks about a host of reasons why sociological evidence would affirm this statement, but we know as Christians that the biblical rationale is quite clear. The Bible is almost always written in a corporate communal scenario. Even at the beginning of the renewal of the church in the book of Acts, we have the disciples coming together, the people coming together to break bread, to hear the word, to confess their sins. There are a variety of one another's in the Bible implying that the idea of an isolated religion is not really a biblical idea, but a more of a modernist concept. The community is very much the backbone of what a society is. And the biblical community of the church forms this foundational community by which and through which all other communities are formed. The great community of the church is from whence wisdom flows into the world, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3. The author goes on to say, we are no longer so deeply embedded in our communities. And here's a very sad statement he makes, that one gauge of social isolation and perhaps selfishness is that one researcher says that he saw families drop elderly family members off at the hospital for Thanksgiving or another long weekend, you know, it sounds to me rather like the practice of a family leaving a dog at a kennel when they're going away. At the hospital, doctors are sometimes the only ones to witness a patient's death with no loved ones around. Now think about that. The elderly are dying alone because the modern society has created this environment where aloneness is actually expected rather than the abnormal way of living. And so it's no wonder that the younger generation of our day, as they grow, they view their parents with a sense of separateness, a sense of divorcedness, so that when they leave the home, they are genuinely alone, left to pursue their own agenda without the moral imperatives of parents, or without the counsel or wisdom of parents. In other words, teenagers going to college are now going their separate route, and parental wisdom is only one of those things that comes in emergency situations. But for the ordinary, parents don't play a role anymore. Is it any wonder, then, that at the latter days of most parents, children are barely around? They're content to send their parents away to a nursing home or some other facility, but they're no longer engaged in the life of their elderly parents. What has happened to our society? We have certainly forgotten our Hebraic background. our Hebraic heritage, where the Christian family remained together. The Christian family cared for aging parents until such a time where there was no physical ability for that family to care for their aging parents. And then they sought the wisdom, the counsel of the church. And if all that failed, perhaps we can talk about the necessity of nursing homes or something of that nature. But for some reason, we have come to the conclusion that our parents can simply be dropped off after Thanksgiving meal to be seen again at the next meeting. It is a very sad reality. No wonder there is loneliness in our society. We have lost our attachment to the people who are nearest to us, the very people who gave us birth. It's a very remarkable topic, so much that in England, as I understand it, they have created a department of loneliness, which sounds relatively comical, but there's something to be said of that. I'm not advocating for any kind of governmental interference in fixing a problem that is inherent in human nature. What I am advocating is that the church take its proper place and address the topic of loneliness. When was the last time our young folks, our single folks in churches, were invited to our homes for a meal? When was the last time widow or a divorced woman or single mother who is alone for Thanksgiving was invited to your home to participate in your familial festivities? And all these things, they play a role in this desert that we find in our society, where loneliness is becoming the norm and community life is becoming abnormal. May the church return to an era where loneliness is merely the absence of communion in Christ, communion in the church. Because what God does in regenerating souls and uniting people to himself is precisely he unites them to him. And Christ is never divorced from his body. The head is never divorced from the body. And so part of community life, part of ecclesiastical life, is precisely eliminating loneliness and incorporating the once lonely, the once foreigner, into a community, into a new land. It's a really fascinating article with a lot of implications for the church, which is how I took it. I applied it directly in that sense. At a practical level, I would strongly urge you to look around your congregation on Sunday. Who is that person who is alone? Who is that person who rarely is invited to your home? Who is that person that generally leaves right after the service? Run out there. Seek them out. Encourage them. Meet with them for coffee. Don't let loneliness be a marker in the life of the church. Be the answer to the loneliness within. The second article came in the Gospel Coalition by John Beeson, and written just this week here. It's entitled, Why I'm a Better Pastor for You Than Keller or Piper. There are a lot of interesting things in this article here. I assume he was writing this to his own congregation. But John Piper retweeted this article positively, saying essentially that he and Keller agree with this article. It's an interesting and fascinating fact, isn't it? Of course, we live in an age where we have access to virtually every conceivable preacher. Virtually every church in America with any pastor of notoriety has his sermons online available to be perused, listened to, researched, analyzed by anyone at any time. It's a remarkable thing how much we are exposed to, the level of knowledge, the ability to get a hold of all of Martin Lloyd-Jones' sermons preached decades ago and listen to them consecutively if you would like. You want to listen to his Romans, famous expository series? Done. His other sermons? Done. How remarkable that John Piper's virtual ministry, his entire ministry, sermon ministry, lecture ministry, his books are all available at our disposal at any time. And the same with Keller. I was just exposed recently to some interactions between R.C. Sproul and his mentor, John Gerstner. Really fascinating, very profound to see that level of material available in the 21st century. And yet, we still live in an age of illiteracy, biblical illiteracy, but that's another question. But the point of the article is that here's the thing. Well, we may find a great appeal in these famous pastors who amass great multitudes of people to listen to them at any time, who have profound rhetorical skills to communicate the gospel in beautiful ways. We treasure these things. At the same time, it is imperative that the local church member understand that these men are not your pastors. The author makes this great point in the article, and he says that, but here's what I can offer my church that those great preachers can't. I'm here. I can shepherd you, he says. I can, if you're patient with me, know your name and your story. Listen, I lived in Orlando where I was relatively exposed to R.C. Sproul on a very face-to-face presence sort of environment. I knew of him. I conversed with him. But R.C. never once asked my story. He probably knew my name for a few meetings and after that forgot it very quickly. R.C. was not my pastor. My pastor was another man who lived in a local city near Orlando who knew my name, who knew my story, with whom I shared my deepest frustrations, my struggles with sin. That's my pastor. Your local pastor, whoever he is, however qualified he is in your mind, however accredited he may be from institutions, however rhetorically gifted he may be, he is the man chosen to minister to you and to proclaim the gospel to you every Sunday or every Wednesday or whenever. He is the one you meet for coffee. John Piper and Tim Keller will be always available to listen, to gain from, but these men will never, or perhaps in occasional situations, be available for you. Your local pastor will. You need to treasure him. He is the ordinary pastor enduring the labor of the gospel faithfully with perseverance, embodying the gospel as he ministers to you through your sufferings, through your happiness, through your baptisms, through your weddings, through the funerals of family members. He is the one who will be with you. Treasure him. Piper and Keller cannot be your pastors, but these men can. A very good word, one that I think ought to be heard by many members who are constantly in a complaint mode that their local pastor doesn't reach the level of sophistication or expository skills as these men. But your local pastor is the one who deserves your encouragement and your support. Remember him on Sunday morning. Remember him. The final topic of conversation is one that's very dear to me. As many of you know, I am a lover of church music. And in particular, I'm a lover of good ecclesiastical music, which almost by definition implies that I have a certain disdain for the language of contemporary music. I'm not opposing contemporary music as anything written in the 21st century. In fact, we sing certain pieces that were written 5-10 years ago. But I'm talking about contemporary music, the kind of music that essentially diminishes the centrality of Jesus, the centrality of the biblical themes of their music. And so it's no surprise that Keith Getty has spoken out against this in an article on thechristianpost.com, article by Leah Marie Ann Klett. And the title of the article is entitled, Keith Getty, Modern Worship Movement is Utterly Dangerous, Causing De-Christianizing of God's People. Now, those are fighting words from any listening who perhaps come from a congregation where there is a praise band and a host of songs put up on some kind of projector up front, some kind of screen. But at the same time, listen at least to the argument here. And the argument is a fairly profound one here. He says that many modern worship songs focus on emotionalism rather than sound doctrine and scriptural truths. This, he said, leads to a generation ill-equipped to understand or defend the Christian faith. Now, that's true. Emotionalism, though I think plays a part of the Psalter's repertoire, cannot be alone the substance of a song. If it's not mixed with the kind of passion, the biblical passion of the Psalter, we lose. Emotionalism becomes by far a rationale to minimize the authority of the Bible. But he goes on to say, and this is fairly fascinating, I think it reaches our point here rather quickly. Getty says, an authentic generation doesn't begin with catharsis. It has to begin with an authentic picture of the God of the Bible. Over 75% of what are called the great hymns of the faith talk about eternity, heaven, hell, and the fact that we have peace with God. Yet, interestingly, he says, quote, less than 5% of modern worship songs talk about eternity. That's a very interesting and fascinating detail here, which means that the majority of songs that are written today, written by so-called composers, remember in the days of Luther, those who composed church music were skilled in music, perhaps had degree in music, played instruments, were well-versed in theology. They weren't novices. They weren't amateurs. They were skilled and gifted theologians who provided a service for the church in music. A very different rationale today, where virtually anyone can write a song without much scriptural accountability. And Getty says that, I believe that the modern worship movement is a movement for cultural relevance. It is a de-Christianizing of God's people, utterly dangerous. I have no quibbles saying enough is enough. This can't happen to build an authentic generation. Again, for those of you familiar with the Getty music, it's a fairly healthy perspective on music. I think I would have some philosophical differences with them, but I think our view ends up in the same place, which is that we want to provide the church the kind of music that hits not only at that emotional string, but that challenges the mind and challenges our reality, and at the same time communicates a kind of robust Christian faith that leaves the singer, the reader, the listener absolutely no doubt that what is being proclaimed is not some generic Christian faith, but precisely the gospel of Jesus Christ in the song we're singing, so that when we sing, we are singing the gospel. We are singing the narrative of scriptures. We are singing about the very pertinent and salient struggles of the martyrs. We're singing truth. We're singing good news, which must include the bad news of who we are outside of Christ, so that we may more properly sing and rejoice in the good news of who we are in Christ and to whom we are united in this gospel fusion, in this gospel rhythm. We are united to Jesus, incorporated into his church, so that the world may see the gospel in all its fullness. And my fear, of course, is that contemporary music is not only building a generation of illiterate Christians, but also diminishing the strength of the church's message. It's essentially saying that that which is ancient is no longer worth it, because now we have innovation, we have creativity. When the reality is that the great hymns of the faith have endured the test of time. And the reason they have endured the test of time across generations is because of their substance, is because of what they communicate, is because of the truth that they communicate, which is a truth that is eternal. It is not a truth that is bound on earth, but a truth that is revealed from heaven. And I think this is a very good word for churches who are contemplating succumbing to the pressures of the youth, for example, abandoning what many consider to be traditional music, traditional hymnody for new things because they think it'll be more attractive or because they think it'll be more appealing or sexier. That is a faulty logic. And I think the warning the Gettys are sounding is very sound and should be heeded by pastors and musicians in the church. If you have enjoyed this conversation, please leave a comment on Twitter or on my blog, yuribrito.com. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you tomorrow.